Good morning, everyone. Good morning. Today is the revision lecture for the course Compensation and Benefits. We have temporarily new course participants, my children Mark and Dave, their presence reflecting the lack of childcare for today. But they will be as quiet as possible, so I think just a simple introduction suffices. So the idea of today's lecture was to go through the questions that people have about the course, and so I solicited people to send me questions regarding the lectures by the end of the last weekend. Okay, so I received only two emails with questions. I don't know why. So either people had no time revising, or everything was super clear, or there's some third, fourth, fifth, and other possibilities for why people didn't react to the offer of going through the lectures and addressing the questions that people have. So, okay, let me start with the questions from Eduardo. Is Eduardo here? Okay, so now, Eduardo had a question about benefits. During the final part of the benefits lecture, we were talking about financing benefit plans, and one possibility was that employee pays total costs for some benefits. What does it mean? A benefit is part of the total compensation, and why must the employee pay? Okay, good question. So, good question. It's a small question, but makes sense. Now, there can be two possibilities, at least two possibilities, that the employee is paying the full, under which the employee will be paying the full cost of the benefit provided to them. Possibility number one, the firm, the employer provides only the benefits up to a certain limit. Or the benefits that the employer provides are limited to a certain range of benefits that can be used, right? So for example, you can have a company car up to a certain specification level, right? Up to a certain engine volume, up to a certain brand, up to a certain price. If you want a more expensive, a more powerful or whatever, better company car, you have to pay for it from your cash compensation. So there can be a limit on the total cash value of the benefits or the range of the benefit services that you can procure on your benefits budget. So that's one possibility. Now the second possibility is that you do pay the full costs of the benefit, but the price of the benefit is given to the firm by the provider of this benefit according to some kind of special deal or bulk discount. So, for example, you can have a transportation benefit, right? So normally when transportation is provided as part of the benefits packages, it's paid for. But it can be that you do pay for the transportation from home to work, from work to home, but the transportation solution is procured by your employer centrally, and therefore you get a bulk discount. So you do pay the full cost of benefit, but you pay a lower cost of the benefit because of the bulk discount that was obtained by your employer. Now, these two possibilities are not never occurring, but they are not very frequent. So the situation in which the employee is paying the full cost of benefit is indeed not the most common, and it seems to go against the common sense that benefits are benefit, you know, it's something that you get, but there are rare circumstances in which it's called benefit, but you end up paying for it. So the second question from Eduardo was administrative question. I decided to publicize it. It's a question that concerns Eduardo personally, but I think there are other Erasmus students. There may be other Erasmus students. Are there any Erasmus students here? Right. So you're the Erasmus student. So I think it's also applicable. So the question is the following. So There is sometimes a clash of schedules between this university and the home university of Erasmus students, right? So either the semester, and the typical situation is that the semester at the home university starts earlier than the end of the exam period, right? What do we do then? So what we do then is we either do oral exam or we simply, you know, there is another arrangement in which we have a Erasmus coordinator at your home university, and you can sit your exam at your home university. Your exam will be emailed to us, we will grade it in a normal way. So there are two such arrangements. Now, what Eduardo has suggested is to signal our status to the professors in order to correct the exam at first to make it possible to send the transcriptions of record to our home university as soon as possible. I don't want to deviate from my plans to accommodate every individual case of Erasmus students. So I think, you know, if you are an Erasmus student, you should have an idea about when lecture starts, when lectures end, when exam starts, when exams end. I'm sure that your program coordinator back at Bologna...
No, it's not a problem about your own university. We had like a final meeting and the Erasmus coordinator here in Constance, they said, could you please ask your professor to be not like late in like 1 month, 2 months, because they have to create documents and send it home.
Right. Yeah, well...
I don't think I have like a deadline.
Right, right. Oh, excellent. So the problem is here.
Yeah.
Okay, so the deadline for returning examination grades for the summer semester, the internal deadline for us is the 31st of August. And I will endeavor to deliver the corrected exams by the 31st of August. The compensation and benefits exam is the exam that I will be grading myself rather than an assistant. That's bad news because given the other responsibilities I have, let alone holiday, I'll be as quick as possible. So I've heard you, I will try to accommodate it.
I mean, because there is some teacher who say we will give you the recall on October.
No. It's 31st of August.
Yeah. Okay. It's okay.
Right. Now, there is, of course, a second attempt for this exam, which indeed takes place sometime in October, and those who want to take it later will therefore have to put up with the corresponding delay in the delivery of the grade. Now, suppose you fail this exam. Let's assume, right? Suppose you fail this exam, then you are in deep trouble because the second attempt to retake this exam will come too late for you. So, yeah. Welcome to the world of second bests, of institutional imperfections, and so on, and so on, and so on. Now, so these are the questions that I received from Eduardo. The only other email that I received regarding the questions for this course was the email that I received from Elisa. Yeah, so you asked a question about firm size and monitoring costs. So let me explain the situation. So Elisa's question was the following. In one of the lectures on the theory behind compensation and benefits, we said that one of the reasons why some firms implement incentive pay while other firms don't implement incentive pay is the possibility to monitor workers' performance. If you can monitor workers' performance, right, then you have less of a need to incentivize the workers because you can impose performance requirements and you can monitor them. So if you have perfect possibility to monitor people's performance, you don't need incentive pay because you can write a contract and you can write a first best contract, and if you have perfect monitoring, you can actually monitor whether the employee has delivered the effort or other measures of performance according to the first best solution that you specified in your contract. The situation is very, very simple then. You choose the first best level of effort corresponding to your maximum profit. You offer to the employee a compensation which will keep him exactly on the participation constraint. You write it down in the contract, and if you have 100% monitoring precision, you can enforce this contract in the court. So there's no agency issue there. So now there is, of course, a spectrum of monitoring possibilities. So there is perfect monitoring, the case of which I've just explained. There is no possibility to monitoring, in which case you have to implement incentives, because otherwise people will just deliver zero effort or a minimum detectable effort. But there is, of course, a gray area in between. So you can monitor, most of the times you can monitor, but with different precision. And it turns out that the more precisely you can monitor people's performance, the less of a need you have in introducing incentives. Now, we see that larger companies have higher pay than smaller companies. And part of the reason, according to the lecture, is that bigger companies can't monitor people's performance very well, and therefore they have to offer either incentives or efficiency wage to make sure that people deliver their performance, because in the case in which they don't deliver, they are fired, and their next job will be at a stochastically lower average wage. Yeah. So Elise's point was, look, bigger companies have more money to spend on monitoring systems, right? So Elise's point was precisely the opposite. Her point was that bigger companies, if anything, are in a better position to monitor employee performance, because basically they can buy more video cameras, they have bigger budgets, right? So here's my response to your point. I've thought about it actually for quite a long time, because it's a strong point. Right? Two things. First, we are talking about managerial supervision here. We are talking about basically the possibility of managers, of company managers, to observe and evaluate and assess and reward employee performance. So the more employees you have in the company, the harder it is to monitor. In family-run firms, you have typically, you know, the owner manager, and you have workers who are somehow related to this owner manager, or, you know, maybe not by blood, but by friendship, social networks, etc., etc. So the agency problem is less in smaller firms, and in smaller firms there is owner-manager, and owner manager has super high incentives to maximize the performance of his of their organization. Why? Because not only is they managers, but they are also owners, so they are residual claimants, and this is the most highly incentivized situation you can have. So it's not so much the question of how many video cameras you can buy, how many monitoring devices you can buy. It's a question of the extent to which you can supervise your employees, and it's also the question of the extent to which you are incentivized to supervise your employees. Consider you know, some really large firm like, for instance, Siemens AG, right? So it's a family-run firm, but it's so super large that the owners of the family rely on thousands of line managers to supervise employees and enforce disciplines. Now, these line managers are not owners. They do receive a bonus. They do receive performance-related pay, sure, but they are not owners. So their incentives are not as high as the incentives of the owners. So they're not going to supervise as tightly as the owners would supervise if they had the physical capacity to do so. So when we talk about the possibility to monitor performance and the differences in the possibility to monitor performance by company size, when we are not talking only about the technical capacities to ensure monitoring and to measure people's, you know, you also mentioned this card system, you enter, you exit. Yeah, we're talking primarily about the possibility of managers or in these firms to supervise their employees and the incentives that managers in these firms have to do so. In smaller firms, these possibilities and incentives are higher. the possibilities to monitor people are better in smaller firms simply because there are fewer people and they typically sit in the same office and it's not geographically spread, so you can actually see what everybody's doing. The incentives to do so are also higher because the managers in smaller firms are typically owner managers. In larger firms, these possibilities are smaller because you have more people and geographically dispersed operations. And you have also the incentives for managers to supervise being more blunt because they're not owner managers. So that's the story. And I was thinking about maybe writing down a little model describing the optimal choice of monitoring intensity and firm size. I haven't had time to do so, but it sounds to me like an excellent master thesis project. So those of you with an inclination to do some maths, to do some, you know, derive some comparative statics on first order conditions, you can consider this problem and write your master thesis either with me or, you know, with someone else. Excellent question. I hope the answer suffices. Okay, right. Now, so it's not a typical situation. Normally, you know, when I taught this course in Frankfurt, I received a lot of questions, and we would even run out of time answering these questions. But these were the only questions I received in preparation for this lecture. So, what are we going to do now? Is my question to you? Okay. We can go through these things once again. That's good. So, we can go through these things once again. Does anybody have a marker pen? By not having a marker pen during my lectures, you're condemning me to a slow death from the shock from hearing chalk. Okay. So, let's go through it. I could also use Windows to write with a marker pen. So this is a very simple, let's start from a very simple situation. And we already mentioned it. We already mentioned it today when we were talking about the, if you have a perfect monitoring possibility, it's the same as the employee's effort being perfectly observed. So if you can perfectly monitor people's performance, you can perfectly observe their effort, and you can provide perfectly accurate evidence to the court about the exact amount of effort that people have put into their work, and then you can write down a first best contract in which you will specify the wage which corresponds to the first best level of effort, and in order to keep the worker on the participation constraint, how much do you have to pay him? You have to pay him the wage which is equal to reservation wage plus the costs of delivering the first best level of effort that maximizes your profit. So you maximize your profit. This is the first order condition from which first best effort is determined. And then you work out the E star, substitute it into here, get the W star. So far, so simple. Okay. Now, and it's also clear why this contract is efficient. Why it is efficient is because the level E star is by definition the level of effort which maximizes the profit. And in order to maximize welfare in the absence of externalities, it's sufficient to maximize the profit. When there are externalities, the situation becomes more complicated, but in this case there are no externalities, as you can see. So that's why when we have perfect observability, we can do first best things that maximize profit, and then as consequence they maximize welfare. Now things become a little bit more interesting when effort is not observed, because when effort is not observed, you don't have the E star in the system, because you can't observe the E. You can only write the contract in terms of the variables that you observe. The wage you, of course, observe, so the wage will always be in the contract. But effort will not be in the contract. It can't be in the contract if you can't observe it. For a very simple reason, that the agent will say, oh, I've put in an effort level of 1 million units, and it's just bad luck that delivered such a bad outcome that we actually observe. And no court will have any evidence to argue against this claim. So don't write contracts in terms of effort if you can't observe the effort. Do write contracts in terms of performance outcomes that you can observe, even though at the cost of some efficiency loss, which is proportional to risk aversion and the degree to which effort is degree of imperfection in output measurement. So here's here's one basic setup describing the situation in which the effort is not observed. A very simple scheme. You can only work hard or you can work less hard. So when you work hard, you put an effort EH. When you're lazy, you put an effort EL. Of course, it's costlier to work hard than to shirk. That also makes sense. So when you work hard, the outcome, there can be two outcomes, PH and PL. Now notice here that there is no one-to-one correspondence between a high effort and high profit and low effort and low profit. If there were one-to-one correspondence, then we would be one slide back. We would be in the world of full efficiency. Now what happens is, if you put in high level of effort, given that you've put in a level of effort EH, the profit will be the high profit with probability P, but with probability 1 minus P, you'll simply have bad luck. It's not zero probability. You will have bad luck and your profit will be PL. Now, if you're lazy, if you shirk, then there is a chance, it's a small chance, but it's not a zero chance. There is a small chance that you will deliver high level of outcome. And one minus this chance with this probability, which is high but not 100%, you will deliver the low level of profit. Now, so this is the setting. Now, let us try to solve the incentive problem here under this setting, assuming that high level of effort is more beneficial to the principal. We need, this assumption makes sense, because what is the alternative to this assumption? The alternative is that low level of effort makes more sense to the principal, and then we can just all go and have a beer and celebrate and not do anything, right? So that's not very interesting. The things become interesting when working harder makes sense, makes commercial sense. So how do you incentivize the agent to work harder than he could work, in the absence of the possibility to measure the agent's effort? Well, you have to make sure that, because you can't observe effort, you have to make sure that the wage parameters, the incentive scheme parameters are such that it is beneficial to the agent himself to choose high level of effort. Now, what do you need to do for this? What do you need to do for this is you need to offer a wage that differs depending on the outcomes. If the outcome is high, you have to give a higher wage. If the outcome is low, you have to give a low wage. So the marginal benefit of effort, this is the marginal benefit of effort, this is the marginal cost of effort. We are in the world where the marginal benefits of effort are larger, or must be larger, than the marginal costs of effort. So the low wage effort is inefficient. Okay, so under this situation, the principal will want to offer an incentive contract. Now, what should this incentive contract look like? There are two constraints, and these constraints, these conditions will always be with you whenever you think about incentives, right? There are two of them. Well, sorry, four, but it's three. So the first constraint is the incentive constraint. What it says? It says that the expected net gain of the agent from working hard should be at least as high, if not higher, than the expected net gain of the agent from being lazy, from shirking. Okay, so let's look at this incentive constraint in greater detail. With probability P, high outcome for the principal will be observed, in which case the agent will get a bonus, BH. Okay? With probability 1 minus P, there's bad luck, and despite putting in high level of effort, you will deliver a low outcome, in which case you have to get a low bonus, BL. Now, this is the expected wage from high effort minus the costs of high effort. That gives you the expected net benefit from high effort. Calculating similarly for this case, you get the net expected benefit from low effort. And the incentive constraint says that if you want the agent to work harder, then almost tautologically, you have to make sure that the benefits from working harder are larger than the benefits from shirking. Now, when you do the algebraic simplification on this constraint, you get this expression. And that's not very interesting. It's just algebra, unless there are specific questions about derivation. No? Okay. Now, the second constraint is the participation constraint. The participation constraint, some people with imagination call it the no slavery constraint. So, and this constraint reflects the fact that we are operating in a free labor market. People can work if they want to work, but if they don't want to work, they don't have to work. So, participation constraint says that agent must prefer to work rather than not to work. In order for the agent to choose to work for the principal out of his own accord, you have to make sure that the net benefit from high effort is at least as high as the agent's reservation wage, is at least as high as the wage, as the amount of income that the agent would get, from Bundesagentur für Arbeit, or you know, from other sources that are not related to work. Now, so these are the two most important constraints. Now there are constraints 3 and 4. Well, it's just one constraint because you can specify many constraints with respect to different elements of the incentive pay package. This is called limited liability constraints. What is the meaning there? You can't pay, most of the time, you cannot pay negative wages to people. In fact, most of the times, you can't pay zero wages to people. Yeah? So reflecting this fact is the limited liability constraint, which says that under no circumstances, whether there's high outcome or low outcome, under no circumstances should the agent receive a negative income. Right? Notice that the limited liability constraint is not specified in terms of net income. You don't see net income here, do you? You see gross income. You see the money that the company, that the principal pays to the agent. If you are asked a question, is it compatible with limited liability constraint or not compatible with limited liability constraint that your actual net income is negative? Then the answer to this question is it is compatible with limited liability constraint, because limited liability constraint specifies the gross income, the money that comes to your bank account at the end of the accounting period. So these are the constraints from which you derive the optimal parameters of the incentive contract. Now, what are the optimal parameters of the incentive contract? Yes?
So we already assume that the incentive constraint holds.
No.
But why then we only subtract the costs of high effort?
Because we want to design the parameters of the contract in such a way that the agent would choose high effort.
But maybe then we could choose the outside option with low effort.
So if you do... low effort can still be above zero, whereas the reservation wage W bar is the wage that you could get under zero effort, under not working at all. So low effort and the effort at which you can get reservation wage are potentially different. Now, but I don't think that this is a satisfactory answer. Let's start from the beginning. We are considering the case in which high effort is more beneficial to the principal than low effort. Okay, so we are, because if it's not the case, then we can all go home, because then everybody can just have some rest. Now, so we want somehow, we want the agent to put in high level of effort, and we're designing incentives, we're designing the incentive contract, BL and BH, in such a way that the agent will choose to put in high effort. And then the question is, under what circumstances will the agent choose to put in high effort? The agent will choose to put in high effort when this is larger than this. And he will choose to put in high effort when his benefit from high effort is at least as high as the reservation wage. We could specify these same constraints in terms of low effort if we want the agent to put in low effort. We could do that. But the solution will not be very interesting. We in particular, if we want the agent to put in low effort, we're not going to offer anything for achieving high outcome, for example, right? But because we want to put agent to put in high effort, we will specify the effort everywhere as EH rather than EL. Is this a sufficient explanation? Okay, right. So these are the constraints. Now, back to my question. How many parameters are there in the incentive contract that we are designing here? How many parameters? How many? 1, 2, 5? How many parameters? 3. Why 3?
No effort.
Outcome. We don't observe effort. So there can be two outcomes, high and low, and to each outcome we have a wage. So how many parameters in this incentive contract? It's 2, right? Now, you can, of course, write down an incentive contract considering the situation in which there is high, intermediate, and low, in which case you'll have to have high, intermediate, and low, so 3 parameters. But in this case, there are only 2, BL and BH. And we have a system of 1, 2, 3, 4 inequalities from which we have to solve for the 2 parameters. Now, these inequalities are not strict inequalities, they're weak inequalities, and weak inequalities typically bind. So this will be an equality because, you know, if it's inequality, then you're paying too much here. This will be also an equality because if it's inequality, then you're paying too much here. And ideally, you want these 2 guys to be equalities. So you have a system of 4 equations in terms of 2 variables. Does this system have a solution? It has a constrained solution. You may or may not have. You will only have an exact solution to all 4 equations if they are somehow related to each other, if they are affine. But if they are linearly independent, if these equations are linearly independent from one another, then if you want to solve for 2 parameters having 4 equations, then 2 of the equations are not going to hold and 2 of the constraints are not going to bind. Let me illustrate exactly what I mean. So if you want to choose, let's temporarily forget the limited liability constraints. Let's forget that we should never pay negative wages to the worker. So we have to deal now with 2 constraints, the incentive constraint and the participation constraint. And we have equation 1, equation 2. In terms of BL and BH, we can solve for BL and BH from these 2 equations. Well, basically, we can express BH as a function of BL from the incentive constraint, then substitute BH expressed as BL into the participation constraint here, solve for BL from the participation constraint, use the expression for BL, put it back into the incentive constraint, solve for BH. So this is just a very simple technical point. And once you're through the process of solution, these are the expressions that determine the amount of the bonus in case when the outcome is high and in case when the outcome is low. So let's have a look at these. Notice that in both cases they have the reservation wage and the costs of effort. Notice, however, that in the event when the outcome is high, the agent receives an amount of money which is larger than his reservation wage plus the costs of effort, because this term is clearly positive, right? C of E of H is larger than C of E of L, and 1 minus P is above zero. Notice also that if in the unfortunate event when the outcome is low, whereas the agent is putting in high effort, the poor agent is actually getting getting less than what it costs him to deliver high effort, because of this term which comes with a negative sign here. Yeah? So the agent is taking a gamble here. Moreover, it could be that in this event, in the event when the low outcome is observed, it could be that this whole thing is negative. If P is large and Q is small, if the difference in effort costs is very high, so this term could well overwhelm this term. So it could be that when the outcome is low, you actually have to pay money back to the principal, right? So it's now therefore time to remember that we have to somehow accommodate the limited liability constraints. We can't pay negative wages to our agent. Now, introducing the limited liability constraints, what do we have here? Well, speaking of limited liability constraints, what is the worry here? The limited liability constraint with respect to BH, will it ever be violated? No, never, because BH is always going to be positive, right? So don't worry about BH. We have to worry about BL, because there can be a situation in which BL is actually negative, which I've just described to you, and that's going to be against the limited liability constraint with respect to BL. So suppose that you've solved this problem, and you found that BL is negative. Now we have to worry about limited liability. Now, limited liability constraint with respect to BL, because this guy can be negative. What is the lowest amount of BL? What is the lowest amount of money that you have to pay to your agent to make sure that the limited liability constraint with respect to BL holds? Is zero. So this is as low as you can get. You can write, or I don't know, you could say BL equal to 1 euro. Or you could sell BL equal to W bar, depending on the lowest amount of money that you can pay to your worker. Suppose you are in the world of minimum wage. Then the BL has to be equal to the minimum wage given the amount of time that the agent spends on the work. So BL is, strictly speaking, not always equal to zero. It's equal to the minimum amount of money that you can pay according to the law of the country. But we assume that it's zero. We assume that it's okay to pay zero, but it's not okay to pay negative. Now, if we said BL equals zero, let's see what happens. If we said BL equals zero, then we have an inefficient solution. Because if the optimal efficient first best BL is negative and we have to pay a positive BL, we are paying too much money. We're paying more money than we have to pay. Okay. So maybe some people say, maybe you could reduce your total wage bill by paying less in the event of high outcome. That's not possible. That's not going to be possible. Why is it not going to be possible? Because look at the incentive constraint. If your BL is zero, incentive constraint is still going to bind. Incentive constraint will be binding, and BH is determined from the incentive constraint. So you can't pay less than you can't pay a lower BH, even when BL is equal to zero. Because if you do so, incentive constraint will break down, and if the incentive constraint breaks down, what level of effort will the agent choose? EL, right? And that's not what we want. So, to conclude, when we calculate the total costs to the principal, In the situation when the limited liability constraint with respect to BL binds, these are going to be the total costs. And these total costs are higher than the total costs to the principal when the limited liability constraint does not bind. When the limited liability constraint, we don't have to worry about it. Because when we don't have to worry about the limited liability constraint, when we can only derive the optimal contract parameters from the participation and incentive constraint, so we can solve these two equations, participation and incentive equations for BL and BH. BL is potentially negative, but never mind. When we calculate the total expected costs to the principal, we'll see that these total expected costs to the principal are equal to exactly the total costs that you would end up paying in the event when you could observe effort, perfectly observe effort. So you can derive a first best contract in this environment if you forget about the limited liability constraint. But if the limited liability constraint binds because this guy is negative, then you're in trouble, because then in order to accommodate the limited liability constraint, you have to pay more than efficiency dictates. How much more? Well, the probability of bad luck times the term R. And this term R is called in the literature, it's called the rent. It's the rent that the agent gets from the principal, because there is a law that says you can't pay negative wages. How high is this rent? Well, it depends on the probability that high effort will deliver high outcome. The higher this probability, the higher the rent that you have to pay as insurance. Now, it also depends on the difference between the probability of delivering high outcome when the effort is high and the probability of delivering high outcome when the effort is low. The larger this difference is, the more rent you have to pay. And obviously, it also depends on the difference in the costs of effort. The more it costs in terms of effort to work harder than shirk, the higher this rent has to be. And you need to also reduce it by the amount of money that you're going to receive in any event, right? So think about this rent as insurance. Think about this rent as insurance. But it's not an actuarially fair insurance. It would have been an actuarially fair insurance if the workers expected income would just keep the worker on the participation constraint, and the firm's costs of providing this contract would just be equal to the expected costs of inducing high effort from the principal. But it turns out that the firm is paying more than it has to for high effort, and the agent is getting more than he has to in order to induce high level of effort. The difference between how much money you have to get in order to work hard and how much money you end up getting because of the limited liability constraint is called the rent. Now, notice in this very simple model, this was just the starting point of our discussion. Notice two things. First, we are talking about two outcomes, high outcome and low outcome. We're not yet talking about a continuum of outcomes, right? And more importantly, we are not yet talking about risk. Is there a risk in this model? Is there, let me put it more precisely. Is there a risk aversion in this model? What do you think? There's no risk aversion. Why is there no risk aversion? Why is the agent risk neutral? Looking at the constraints, looking at the incentive and participation constraint. Why is the agent risk neutral here? How can we see that the agent is risk neutral? Because this is the expected income of the agent. It's just equal to the mathematical expectation of the income if he puts in high level of effort, right? But if the agent were risk averse, that sounds like an interesting question for the exam. It's may or may not be in the exam, because I've already completed the exam questions and I'm not going to make any changes, right? But so sounds like an interesting question anyway. The interesting question is the following. Suppose the agent is risk averse rather than risk neutral. How would you rewrite the incentive and participation constraints in this case to accommodate, to account for the fact that the agent is risk averse rather than risk neutral. Any idea? Yeah?
We write it in terms of utility, not in terms of expected.
In terms of certainty equivalent, I think you wanted to say, right? So what would be the certainty equivalent? Yeah, yeah. So the let's remember the formula for the certainty equivalent. The formula for the certainty equivalent is where X is the random variable, right? So X can be with if you're putting in high level of effort, X with probability P is going to be pi H, and with probability 1 minus P it's going to be pi L, right? So the expected value of X is precisely what you see here. Oh, sorry, not pi but B, because we're talking about wage. Now, what is the variance of X? With probability P, you're going to get BL. Sorry, BH. With probability 1 minus P, you're going to get BL. So here's your random variable. Takes two values. BL with probability 1 minus P. And BH with probability P. What's the variance of this thing? Anybody? The variance? So, well, we can use the definition of the variance, right? Definition of the variance? So what is the expected value? Is B H times P plus BL times 1 minus P. That's the expected, right? So what is the variance? Is the expected of the difference between the actual and the expected squared, right? So what we have here is P times BH minus BH times P minus BL times 1 minus P squared plus 1 minus P times BL minus BH times P minus BL times 1 minus P all squared, right? So you will see, I'm sure you'll simplify at home and find a very compact expressions for the variance. So these two constraints, the incentive constraint changes when you allow for risk aversion. The incentive constraint changes by adding the provision, by adding the risk premium for the agent. So in here, it has to be the risk premium which corresponds to high effort. And in here, it has to be the risk premium corresponding to the low effort. Now, what is the risk premium? Is the risk premium corresponding to the high effort higher or lower than the risk premium corresponding to the low effort? What do you think? The risk premium corresponding to high effort, is it higher, lower, or equal than the risk premium corresponding to the low effort? Any idea? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think if you put higher effort, the risk premium will be higher.
It should be higher. So the risk premium, the negative component that you have to add here, the risk premium, should be higher for the high effort than for the low effort. And what will happen is if you allow for risk aversion by rewriting these constraints that will take into account the risk premium, you will end up paying more, paying higher bonus to your agent in the event of high outcome. And the low bonus will, I think, stay the same, but check it at home. Now, the participation constraint, in the participation constraint, we'll have to also add the risk premium for the high effort. So you will make the participation constraint heavier. You have to pay more money to offset, because not only do you have to offset the costs of effort by paying high bonus or low bonus depending on the outcome, you also have to introduce the costs of bearing the risk by the agent who has to choose to put in high effort. And these costs are not zero when the agent is risk averse. So everything will become more expensive for you to provide as the principal. Now, in the case when the agent is risk averse rather than risk neutral, is the solution with respect to BL and BH first best or not first best? Is it efficient or not efficient? What do you think? When the agent is risk averse? Why not?
Because we have to compensate for the risk.
We have to compensate for the cost of risk. So whenever you have risk aversion in the story, you're never going to get efficient solution. Why? Because you will always have to compensate for the cost of risk. Now, I think it's time to ask people, let me remember. Who initiated this question about when effort is observed? I think you did. So, shall we continue or shall we,
Yeah, I think it's okay. I understood the intuition, but still sometimes I get stuck in the intuition. How should I do the calculation?
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it's important to do the calculations by myself or rather interpret the results.
It's both. Oh, wasn't it your question also in the email you said looking at the, or was it somebody else's question? Looking at the, looking at the past exam, was you again, right? Yes, right. So I remember there were two emails. Now, so past exam, you could see, you may want to see that in the past exam there are multiple references to the papers, right? And your question was, should we, what is the status of the exam for this course? Now, in this course we had different tutorials. One thing that was different is because we've lost one tutorial that we planned. So, and the second thing that was different is that differently from the previous years in which this course was taught, previous tutorials were all about papers. There was not a single tutorial about derivation, about doing some exercises, right? So in this year, we had tutorials that were mostly about derivation, that were mostly about doing exercises. Now, so we have studied fewer papers. This course has studied fewer academic papers than the previous editions of this course, right? But still, we have studied some academic papers during lectures. For instance, Bandiera, Baranca and Rasul, Hossein and List, Lazier 2000, right? The Big Stakes, Large Mistakes paper by Gnisi, Löwenstein, Mazur, somebody else. Remember this paper in the Review of Economic Studies, 2009? So the papers that we study during the lectures are exam relevant. The papers that we didn't study during the lectures are not exam relevant. Now, there were questions specifically about papers outlined the estimation procedure and that. These questions were influenced by the tutorials that were all about academic papers. This course is different, therefore, of course, there will not be such specific exact questions about academic papers. Does it mean that you don't have to read the papers mentioned in this course? No, it doesn't. You have to read them.
It was about specifics.
Yeah, the specificity of questions about academic papers will be limited by the extent to which they were covered in the lectures. So if, for instance, I covered Bandiera, Barankai, and Razul, remember the bonus to managers? Mm-hmm. We covered not only the general idea and findings that bonus to managers improves worker performance, we also covered ways how to identify the two channels through which this effect was delivered, the selection effect and targeting effect, right? So the question could be, how did they identify the targeting effect? Or how could they identify the selection effect? Then, of course, the answer to the selection effect question was, well, they identified the selection effect by looking at the unemployment figures before and after, and by employment figures of the more productive and less productive workers. And what they found is that even though the unemployment of both groups has gone up after the introduction of the manager bonus, the unemployment of the more productive people has gone up not so much as the unemployment of the less productive people. So in relative terms, the more productive people became more employable and the less productive people became less employable. And that implies that there is a selection effect, that managers are now more likely to select more productive people into work than before this bonus was introduced, right? So only things covered in the lectures will be mentioned in the exam, as far as academic papers are concerned. Now, going back to Elisa's question about the extent to which derivations are important. Yeah, derivations are important. It's a master level course. People have to be good at maths. Well, what does it mean, good at maths? If being able to take first order condition is your idea of being good at maths, then yeah, that's sort of how good at maths you have to be. But when I feel that it's difficult, I tend to give people hints. When I don't feel that it's difficult, there's no hint. But then it's not difficult. Suppose you've come to the exam. When is your exam, by the way?
This Saturday.
Yeah.
Okay, this Saturday. So it means I can't physically be there, but I am available on the phone. It's the exam regulation that the course professor has to be erreichbar, right? So has to be reachable. So I am reachable on Saturday, and if you see some funny questions on the exam, if you think that it's really not correct or it doesn't have complete information, you can always ask the question. The attendant will come to you, and they can call me. Can put me in touch with the student, and we can go through it. So I am on the phone. If you think that these questions are really strange and not make sense, and or are outside the scope of the course, feel free to raise this issue with me, and I will respond to it promptly. Yeah, but don't worry. You've been good students. You've come to every lecture. You've asked lots of questions. Well, with the exception of today's lecture. But normally you've asked questions, right? And normally you have been very good at participating in the lectures and asking questions and trying to learn things. That, I think, makes you, very well prepared for the exams. Don't worry about the exam. Just make sure you know the course material and stop worrying about the exam. You will do well. If you haven't learned or have misunderstood something or have neglected something, then of course you're going to pay. But otherwise, I don't see why you should do badly on the exam. I think you've been a very good class altogether, right? So any other questions? Any other requests to go through some results in the lecture? Please feel free. We have half an hour or so where we can do that. And we have the class today during which we will go through the last year's exam to the extent to which it's relevant for this exam.
I have just a short question.
Yes,
about,
please.
Job grades, job ranges.
Job grades, job ranges. Okay.
We talked about job ranges and salary ranges, and I cannot understand because there are like overlaps in job grades. For example, here we have like the model is not good here. But we have this salary level,
yeah,
and it could be the same in the next range. So sometimes we can just pass through an higher range, just for recognizing, or if we pass to another range, we should increase also the salary.
Right. So let me formulate your question for the benefit. So the question was, So the question was, you have salary ranges and grade ranges, job grade ranges, and the two intersect. So here's your wage. And here is your job grade. So here is grade 1, grade 2, grade 3, grade 4, etc. 1, 2, 3, 4. And the question is, why do you have intercepts between the why do you have intercepts between salary ranges for different job grades, right? Was that your question? Okay, so in order to make the otherwise very inflexible system a little bit more flexible, right? So you can promote people within the same job grade to a higher level of the same job grade, to a higher wage level. So suppose I was job grade 2, my salary was here, and I am promoted to, my job grade will also be grade 2, but my salary is now 500 euros more, so I am here. So that's one way I can be promoted. Or I could be promoted from job grade 2 to job grade 3 without any increase in the wage. Or I can be promoted from job grade 2 to job grade 3 with any given gradient in job, in wage. So my wage can be higher, my wage can be way higher, right? So in order to enable promotions and demotions in terms of both job grade and salary ranges, you have these intercepts. Now, within the same, for promotions within the same, so one purpose is to serve promotions within the same organization. The other purpose is to accommodate the frequently occurring misalignment between the external labor market conditions and the internal wage ranges within the same organization. I remember I gave you numerous examples of this, right? So you have somebody within, you know, so suppose you are job grade 4, you're very senior, this is your wage, your actual wage. Now you want to hire someone from job grade 3, you want to hire someone who is equivalent in terms of qualifications, but the market wages are way higher than the wage that you're paying to this holder of job grade 4 at the moment, right? This person may really have very significant compensating wage differential from this work. It's closer to home. He likes the group and whatever. But the market wage is higher than the wage that this guy is getting. So how can you accommodate it? You can either try to hire someone for the same job grade and for the same wage, or failing that, if you have to pay higher wage, you can hire someone from a lower job grade. Can you do so? Yes, you can. Yes, you can. And then when you hear a complaint from this person, you say, but look, they are junior job grades. They don't have as many perquisites and as many benefits as you do. So you can, at least you can make a case for some sort of quasi-equality between this person and who is currently underpaid given the market conditions and the newly hired people who have to be hired at the going market wage, but this going market wage is such that it's higher than the wages of the people who you currently employ. Yeah. It is an empirical fact that wage growth is on average higher of the people who change more jobs. So if you want higher wage, trying to build a career within the same organization is stochastically not the best option that you can take. Chances are that you are more successful to gain higher wage growth if you move between jobs. Now, in order for the organization to which you move to have the possibility to accommodate the misalignment between the wages of the entrenched workers and the market wage, they need to have some intercept between job and wage ranges in order to accommodate this. Right? Does this make sense? Yeah. You can employ a junior professor who is comes from a very famous US university or whatever. They will not come for the average junior professor's wage in Germany, no way. But you can offer them a high grade of junior professorship, the highest grade possible, with reduced teaching load, etc. There's someone who is senior professor here, but someone who is, let's say, not very productive recently. They will be getting close to the bottom of the senior professorship. And when you hire a junior with a higher wage, then the question is, why is he getting more than I do? And the answer is, well, everything is within the range. Everything is within the salary range. So you can't take your firm to the court and complain of wage discrimination.
Maybe, for example, the senior professor will have a very big office and the junior a very small, or
could be. It depends on the case that you make. But even if you don't have a case, suppose you don't have a case, then this underpaid person, more senior person, may complain and may even take you to the court. But as long as the wage is within the range, he has no case. Yeah. So it's largely administrative arrangement to increase the flexibility of wage setting. But I've already sent it to print, and it's already water under the bridge, for me at least. So, okay, now, I guess if there are no questions, let's meet at the tutorial. We'll go through the last year's exam. Okay, see you there at 3:15.